Side 3, The Tommyknockers, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 66. I almost fall asleep, and then I hear her.
Who?
He asks gently. Sissy. My sister Anne, that is. She grinds her teeth, and it sounds like... bones. She wanted to say, but then she woke into a fit of hysterical weeping that had frightened him very badly. Anne. More than anything else, Anne was Layton Street. Anne had been...
knocking at the door.
The gag of Bobby's needs and ambitions.
Okay,
Guard thought.
For you, Bobby. Only for you.
And began to read Layton Street as smoothly as if he had spent the afternoon rehearsing it in his room. These streets begin where the cobbles surface through tar, like the heads of children buried badly in their textures. Gardner read. What myth is this, we ask. But the children who play stickball and Johnny Jump My Pony round here just laugh. No myth, they tell us. No myth. Just. They say, hey, motherfucker, ain't nothing but Layton Street here. Ain't nothing but all small houses. Ain't only but back porches where our mothers wash there and there and there. Where days grow hot, and on Layton Street they listen to the radio while pterodactyls flow between the TV aerials on the roof. And they say, hey, motherfucker. They say, hey, motherfucker. No myth, they tell us. No myth. Just they say, hey, motherfucker, ain't nothing but Layton Street around here. This, they say, is how you be silent in your silence of days. Motherfucker. When we turned our back on these upstate roads, warehouses with faces of blank brick, when you say, oh, but I have reached the end of all I know and still hear her grinding, grinding in the night. Because it had been so long since he had read the poem, even to himself, he did not just perform it. Something he had discovered that was almost impossible not to do at the end of a tour such as this. He rediscovered it. Most of those who came to the reading at Northeastern that night, even those who witnessed the evening's sordid, creepy conclusion, agreed that Gardner's reading of Layton Street had been the best of the night. A good many of them maintained it was the best they had ever heard. Since it was the last reading Jim Gardner would ever give in his life, it was maybe not such a bad way to go out. 6. It took him nearly 20 minutes to read all of it, and when he finished, he looked up uncertainly into a deep and perfect well of silence. He had time to think he had never read the damn thing at all, that it had just been a vivid hallucination in the moment or two before the faint. Then someone stood up and began to clap. Steadily and hard. It was a young man with tears on his cheeks. The girl beside him also stood and began to clap, and she was also crying. Then they were all standing and applauding. Yeah, they were giving him a fucking standing O, and in their faces he saw what every poet or would-be poet hopes to see when he or she finished reading. The faces of people suddenly awakened from a dream brighter than any reality. They looked as dazed as Bobby had on that day, not quite sure where they were. But they weren't all standing and applauding, he saw. Patricia McCardle sat stiff and straight in her third-row seat, her hands clasped tightly together in her lap over her small evening bag. Her lips had closed. No sign of the old pearly whites now. Her mouth had become a small, bloodless cut. Guard felt a weary amusement.
As far as you're concerned, Patty, the real Puritan ethic is no one who's a black sheep should dare rise above his designated level of mediocrity, correct? But there's no mediocrity clause in your contract, is there?
Thank you, he muttered into the mic, sweeping his books and papers together into an untidy pile with his shaking hands, and then almost dropping them all over the floor as he stepped away from the podium. He dropped into his seat next to Ron Cummings with a deep sigh.
My God,
Ron whispered, still applauding.
My God. Stop clapping, you ass,
Gardner whispered back.
Damned if I will. I don't care when you wrote it, it was fucking brilliant,
Cummings said.
And I'll buy you a drink on it later on.
I'm not drinking anything stronger than club soda tonight,
Gardner said, and knew it was a lie. His headache was already creeping back. Aspirin wouldn't cure that. Percodan wouldn't. Alude wouldn't. Nothing would fix his head but a great big clout of booze. Fast, fast relief. The applause was finally beginning to die away. Patricia McCardle looked acidly grateful. 7. The name of the fat shit who had introduced each of the poets was Arberg, although Gardner kept wanting to call him Argle-Bargle, and he was the assistant professor of English who headed the sponsoring group. He was the sort of man his father had called a beefy son of a whore. The beefy son of a whore threw a party for the caravan, the friends of poetry, and most of the English department faculty at his house after the reading. It began around 11 o'clock. It was stiffish at first, men and women standing in uncomfortable little groups with glasses and paper plates in their hands, talking your usual brand of cautious academic talk. This sort of bullshit had struck Gard as a stupid waste of time when he was teaching. It still did. But there was also something nostalgic and pleasing, in a melancholy way, about it now. His party monster streak told him that, stiff or not, this was a party with possibilities. By midnight, the Bach etudes would almost certainly be replaced by the pretenders, and talk of classes, politics, and literature would be replaced by more interesting fare. The Red Sox, who on the faculty was drinking too much, and that all-time favorite, who was fucking whom. There was a large buffet for which most of the poets made a beeline, reliably following Gardner's first rule for touring poets, if it's gratis, grab it. As he watched, Anne Delaney, who wrote spare, haunting poems about rural, working-class New England, stretched her jaws wide and ripped into the huge sandwich she was holding. Mayonnaise, the color and texture of bull semen, squirted between her fingers, and Anne licked it off her hand nonchalantly. She tipped Gardner a wink. To her left, last year's winner of Boston University's Hawthorne Prize for his long poem Harbor Dreams, 1650 to 1980, was cramming green olives into his mouth with blurry speed. This fellow, John Edwards Symington by name, paused long enough to drop a handful of wrapped mini-wheels of Bombelle cheese into each pocket of his corduroy sport coat, patched elbows, naturally, and then went back to the olives. Ron Cummings strolled over to where Gardner was standing. As usual, he wasn't eating. He had a Waterford glass that looked full of straight whiskey in one hand. He nodded toward the buffet.
Great stuff. If you're a connoisseur of Kirshner's bologna and iceberg lettuce, you in like Flynn, Bo. That Argle-Bargle really knows how to live, Gardner said.
Cummings, in the act of drinking, snorted so hard his eyes bulged.
You're on the hit line tonight, Jim. Argle-Bargle. Cheesy.
He looked at the glass in Gardner's hand. It was a vodka and tonic. Weak, but his second just the same.
Tonic water?
Cummings asked slyly.
Well, mostly.
Cummings laughed again and walked away. By the time someone pulled Bach and put on B.B. King, Gard was working on his fourth drink. On this one he'd asked the bartender, who had been at the reading, to go a little heavier on the vodka. He had begun to repeat two remarks that seemed wittier as he got drunker. First, that if you were a connoisseur of Kirshner's bologna and iceberg lettuce, you were in like Flynn here, Bo. And second, that all assistant professors were like T.S. Eliot's practical cats in at least one way. They all had secret names. Gardner confided that he had intuited that of their host, Argle-Bargle. He went back for a fifth drink and told the bartender just to wave the tonic bottle in that old drink's face. That would be fine. The bartender waggled the bottle of Schweppes solemnly in front of Gardner's glass of vodka. Gardner laughed until tears stood in his eyes and his stomach hurt. He really was feeling fine tonight. And who, sir or madam, deserved it more? He had read better than he had in years, maybe in his whole life.
You know,
he told the bartender, a needy post-grad hired especially for the occasion.
All assistant professors are like T.S. Eliot's practical cats in one way.
Is that so, Mr. Gardner?
Jim. Just Jim.
But he could see from the look in the kid's eyes that he was never going to be just Jim to this guy. Tonight he had seen Gardner blaze, and men who blazed could never be anything so mundane as just Jim.
It is, he told the kid. Each of them has a secret name. I have intuited that of our host. It's Argobargle, like the sound you make when you use the old Listerine.
He paused, considering.
Of which the gentleman under discussion could use a good dose, now that I think of it.
Gardner laughed quite loudly. It was a fine addition to the basic thrust.
Like adding a tasteful hood ornament to a fine car,
he thought, and laughed again. This time a few people glanced around before going back to their conversation.
Too loud,
he thought.
Turn down your volume control, guard, old buddy.
He grinned widely, thinking he was having one of those magic nights. Even his damn thoughts were funny tonight. The bartender was also smiling, but his smile had a slightly concerned edge to it.
You ought to be careful what you say about Professor Arberg, he said. Or who you say it to. He's a bit of a bear. Oh, is he?
Gardner popped his eyes round and waggled his eyebrows energetically up and down like Groucho Marx.
Well, he's got the build for it. Beefy son of a whore, ain't he?
But he was careful to keep the old volume control down when he said it.
Yeah,
the bartender said. He looked around and then leaned over the makeshift bar toward Gardner.
There's a story that he happened to be passing by the grad assistant's lounge last year and heard one of them joking about how he'd always wanted to be associated with a school where Moby Dick wasn't just another dry classic, but an actual member of the faculty. That guy was one of the most promising English students Northeastern has ever had, I heard, but he was gone before the semester was over. So was everyone who laughed. The ones who didn't laugh stayed.
Jesus Christ,
Gardner said. He had heard stories like it before, one or two that were even worse, but still felt disgusted. He followed the bartender's glance and saw Argobargle at the buffet standing next to Patricia McCardle. Argobargle had a stein of beer in one hand and was gesturing with it. His other hand was plowing potato chips through a bowl of clam dip and then conveying them to his mouth, which went right on talking as it slobbered them chips in. Gardner could not remember ever having seen anything so quintessentially disgusting. Yet the McCardle bitch's rapt attention suggested that she might at any moment drop to her knees and give the man a blowjob out of sheer adoration. Gardner thought,
and the fat fuck would go right on eating while she did it, dropping potato chip crumbs and globs of clam dip in her hair.
Jesus wept,
he said, and slugged back half of his vodka sans tonic. It hardly burned at all. What burned was the evening's first real hostility, the first outrider of that mute and inexplicable rage that had plagued him almost since the time he began drinking.
Freshen this up, would you?
The bartender dumped in more vodka and said shyly, I thought your reading tonight was wonderful, Mr. Gardner. Gardner was absurdly touched. Leighton Street had been dedicated to Bobby Anderson, and this boy behind the bar, barely old enough to drink legally himself, reminded Gardner of Bobby as she had been when she first came to the university.
Thank you.
You want to be a little careful of that vodka, the bartender said. It has a way of blindsiding you.
I'm in control,
Gardner said, and gave the bartender a reassuring wink.
Visibility 10 miles to unlimited.
He pushed off from the bar, glancing toward the beefy son of a whore and McCardle again. She caught him looking at her and gazed back, cool and unsmiling, her blue eyes chips of ice.
Bite my bag, you frigid bitch,
he thought, and raised his drink to her in a boorish barrel-house salute, at the same time favoring her with an insultingly wide grin.
Just tonic, right? Pure tonic?
He looked around. Ron Cummings had appeared at his side as suddenly as Satan, and his grin was properly satanic.
Bugger off,
Gardner said, and more people turned around to look.
Jim, old buddy. I know, turn down the volume control.
He smiled, but he could feel that pulse in his head getting harder, more insistent. It wasn't like the headaches the doctor had predicted following his accident. It didn't come from the front of his head, but rather from someplace deep in the back. And it didn't hurt. It was, in fact, rather pleasant.
You got it.
Cummings nodded almost imperceptibly toward McArdle.
She's got a heavy down on you, Jim. She'd love to dump you off the tour. Don't give her a reason. Fuck her.
You fuck her, Cummings said.
Cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, and brain damage are all statistically proven results of heavy drinking, so I could reasonably expect any of them in my future, and if one of them were to come down on my head, I'd have no one to blame but myself. Diabetes, glaucoma, and premature senility all run in my family, but hypothermia of the penis? That I can do without, excuse me.
Gardner stood still for a moment, puzzled, watching him go. Then he got it and brayed laughter. This time the tears did not just stand in his eyes, this time they actually rolled down his cheek. For the third time that evening, people were looking at him. A big man in rather shabby clothes, with a glass full of what looked suspiciously like straight vodka, standing by himself and laughing at the top of his voice.
Put a lid on it,
he thought.
Turn down the volume,
he thought.
Hypothermia of the penis,
he thought, and sprayed more laughter. Little by little, he managed to regain control. He headed for the stereo in the other room. That was where the most interesting people at a party were usually found. He grabbed a couple of canapés from a tray and swallowed them. He had a strong feeling that Argle Bargle and McArgle Bargle were looking at him still, and that McArgle Bargle was giving Argle Bargle a complete rundown on him in neat phrases, that cool, maddening little smile never leaving her face.
You didn't know.
It's quite true. He shot her. Right through the face. She told him she wouldn't press charges if he would give her an uncontested divorce. Who knows if it was the right decision or not. He hasn't shot any more women, at least not yet. But however well he might have read tonight, after that rather eccentric lapse, I mean, he is unstable, and as you can see, he's not able to control his drinking.
Better watch it, guard,
he thought, and for the second time that night, a thought came in a voice that was very much like Bobby's.
Your paranoia is showing. They're not talking about you, for Christ's sake.
At the doorway, he turned and looked back. They were looking directly at him. He felt nasty, dismayed shock race through him, and then he forced another big, insulting grin and tipped his glass toward both of them.
Get out of here, guard. This could be bad. You're drunk. I'm in control. Don't worry. She wants me to leave. That's why she keeps looking at me. That's why she's telling that fat fuck all about me. That I shot my wife, that I was busted at Seabrook with a loaded gun in my pack sack. She wants to get rid of me because she doesn't think drunken wife-shooting commie-simp nuclear protesters should get the biggest motherfucking hand of the night. But I can be cool. No problem, baby. I'm just going to hang out. Taper off on the fire water, grab some coffee, and go home early. No problem.
And although he didn't drink any coffee, didn't go home early, and didn't taper off on the fire water, he was okay for the next hour or so. He turned down the volume control every time he heard it start going up, and made himself quit every time he heard himself doing what his wife had called holding forth. When you get drunk, Jim, she had said, not the least of your problems is a tendency to stop conversing and start holding forth. He stayed mostly in Arberg's living room, where the crowd was younger and not so cautiously pompous. Their conversation was lively, cheerful, and intelligent. The thought of the nukes rose in Gardner's mind, at hours such as this it always did, like a rotting body floating to the surface in response to cannon fire. At hours such as these, and at this stage of drunkenness, the certainty that he must alert these young men and women to the problem always floated up, trailing its heat of anger and irrationality like rotted waterweed. As always, the last 6 years of his life had been bad, and the last three had been a nightmare time in which he had become inexplicable to himself and scary to almost all the people who really knew him. When he drank, this rage, this terror, and most of all this inability to explain whatever had happened to Jimmy Gardiner, to explain even to himself, found outlet in the subject of the nukes. But tonight he had hardly raised the subject when Ron Cummings staggered into the parlor, his narrow, gaunt face glowing with feverish color. Drunk or not, Cummings was still perfectly able to see how the wind was blowing. He adroitly turned the conversation back toward poetry. Gardiner was weakly grateful, but also angry. It was irrational, but it was there. He had been denied his fix. So, partly thanks to the tight check rein he had imposed on himself, and partly due to Ron Cummings' timely intervention, Gardiner avoided trouble until Arberg's party was almost over. Another half hour, and Gardiner might have avoided trouble completely, at least for that night. But when Ron Cummings began to hold forth on the beat poets with his customary cutting wit, Gardiner wandered back into the dining room to get another drink and perhaps something to nosh on from the buffet. What followed might have been arranged by a devil with a particularly malignant sense of humor.
"Once we've got Iroquois online, you'll have the equivalent of 3 dozen full scholarships to give away,"
a voice on Gardner's left was saying. Gardner looked around so suddenly that he almost spilled his drink. Surely he must be imagining this conversation. It was too coincidental to be real. Half a dozen people were grouped at one end of the buffet, 3 men and 3 women. One of the couples was that world-famous vaudeville team of Argle-Bargle and McCargle-Bargle. The man speaking looked like a car salesman with better-tasting clothes than most of the breed. His wife stood next to him. She was pretty, in a strained way, her fading blue eyes magnified by thick spectacles. Gardner saw one thing at once. He might be an alky, and obsessive on this one subject, but he had always been a sharp observer and still was. The woman with the thick spectacles was aware that her husband was doing exactly that which Nora had accused Gard himself of doing at parties once he got drunk, holding forth. She wanted to get her husband out, but as yet couldn't see how to do it. Gardner took a second look and guessed they had been married 8 months. Maybe a year, but 8 months was a better guess. The man speaking had to be some sort of wheel with Bay State Electric. Had to be Bay State, because Bay State owned the boondoggle that was the Iroquois plant. This guy was making it sound like the greatest thing since sliced bread, and because he looked as though he really believed it, Gardner decided he must be a wheel of a rather small sort, maybe even a spare tire. He doubted if the big guys were so crazy about Iroquois. Even putting aside the insanity of nuclear power for a moment, there was the fact that Iroquois was 5 years late coming online, and the fate of 3 interconnected New England bank chains depended on what would happen when, and if, it did. They were all standing chest deep in radioactive quicksand and trading paper. It was like some crazy game of musical chairs. Of course, the courts had finally given the company permission to begin loading hot rods the month before, and Gardiner supposed that had the motherfuckers breathing a little easier. Arberg was listening with solemn respect. He wasn't a trustee of the college, but anyone above the post of instructor would know enough to butter up an emissary from Bay State Electric, even a spare tire. Big private utilities like Bay State could do a lot for a school if it wanted to. Was Reddy Kilowatt here a friend of poetry? About as much, Gard suspected, as he himself was a friend of the neutron bomb. His wife, however, she of the thick glasses and the strained, pretty face, she looked like a friend of poetry. Knowing it was a terrible mistake, Gardiner drifted over. He was wearing a pleasant, late in the party, gotta go soon smile, but the pulse in his head was faster, centering on the left. The old, helpless anger was rising in a red wave. "Don't you know what you're talking about?" was almost all that his heart could cry. There were logical arguments against nuclear power plants that he could muster, but at times like this he could only find the inarticulate cry of his heart. "Don't you know what you're talking about? Don't you know what the stakes are? Don't any of you remember what happened in Russia 2 years ago? They haven't. They can't. They'll be burying the cancer victims far into the next century. Jesus jumped up, fiddling Christ. Stick one of those used core rods up your ass for half an hour or so and tell everyone how safe nuclear power is when your turds start to glow in the dark.
Jesus. Jesus. You jerks are standing here listening to this man talk as if he was sane.
He stood there, drink in hand, smiling pleasantly, listening to the spare tire spout his deadly nonsense. The third man in the group was 50 or so, and looked like a college dean. He wanted to know about the possibility of further organized protests in the fall. He called the spare tire Ted. Ted the power man said he doubted there was much to worry about. Seabrook had had its vogue, and the Arrowhead installation in Maine, but since the federal judges had started to deal out some stiff sentences for what they saw as merely hell-raising, the protests had slowed down fast.
"These groups go through targets almost as fast as they go through rock groups," he said.
Arberg, McCardle, and the others laughed, all except the wife of Ted the Power Man. Her smile only frayed a little more. Gardner's pleasant smile remained. It felt flash frozen onto his face. Ted the Power Man grew more expansive. He said it was time to show the Arabs once and for all that America and Americans didn't need them. He said that even the most modern coal-fired generators were too dirty to be acceptable by the EPA. He said that solar power was great,
as long as the sun shines.
There was another burst of laughter. Gardner's head thudded and whipped and thudded. His ears, tuned to an almost preternatural pitch, heard a faint crackling sound like ice shifting, and he relaxed his hand a bare moment before it tightened enough to shatter the glass. He blinked, and Arberg had the head of a pig. This hallucination was utterly complete and utterly perfect, right down to the bristles on the fat man's snout. The buffet was in ruins, but Arberg was scavenging, finishing up the last few triscuits, sparing a final slice of salami and chunk of cheese on the same plastic toothpick, chasing them with the last potato chip crumbs. It all went into his snuffling snout, and he went on nodding all the while as Ted the Power Man explained that nuclear was the only alternative, really.
"Thank God the American people are finally getting that Chernobyl business into some kind of perspective," he said. 32 people dead. It's horrible, of course, but there was an airplane crash just a month ago that killed 190-some. You don't hear people yelling for the government to shut down the airlines, though, do you? 32 dead is horrible, but it's far from the Armageddon these nuke freaks make it sound like.
He lowered his voice a little.
They're as nuts as the LaRouche people you see in airports, but in a way they're worse. They sound more rational. But if we gave them what they wanted, they'd turn around a month or so later and start whining about not being able to use their blow dryers, or found out their Cuisinarts weren't going to work when they wanted to mix up a bunch of macrobiotic food.